I'm Randy Thornton. I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
Good morning. What a beautiful day and what a beautiful crowd and what a beautiful retreat this has been. We've just had a ball up here. You know, when Tina and I came up here, we found out Bob and Juanita were going to be here, and we were on a program together at Myrtle Beach, and those were the only two people that we knew. And today I'll leave here with a bunch of people that I felt like I've known all my life, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. That's what that's about. This is a very special day. It's a special day for my wife. Tina, stand up, honey. Two or three of you haven't met her yet, and Tina is celebrating her 46th birthday today, so it is indeed a special day. She's a lot older than I am. You can tell that right away. I am an alcoholic, and my sobriety date is December the 3rd, 1982, and if I stay sober 10 more days, that'll be 15 years, and that is truly a marvelous miracle in my life. And you know, if that was all I got from Alcoholics Anonymous, that would be a pretty good deal, but I've gotten so much more. In fact, anything that I know about life or about living in this world today, I've learned right here and Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, some people have already asked me if I'm nervous. I'm going to tell you right now, I do not get nervous before I share my story. I get excited. I'm a little hyper. The symptoms are similar. You know, your hands sweat and your mouth gets dry. So from time to time, I lick my hands, and that'll just keep everything in balance. But I'm not nervous because this morning I had some quiet time with God, as I understand Him, and this thing has always worked out well. I'm cognizant of the time up here. My sponsor said, if you don't speak more than an hour, you'll never have to be alone again. So I'm gonna try to keep that in mind. My home group is a pass-it-on group in Morganton, North Carolina, and we have an open speakers meeting every Wednesday night at 8 o'clock. If you're ever in the area, we ask you to drop by. We meet at the Flynn home, and at this point in my life, it's the best group for me. And if you don't think your home group's the best group, don't go screw somebody else's up. Just stay there and try to make it a little bit better. I always like to start my story by telling a little story that's so very descriptive of me, particularly in my latter days of drinking. And it kind of loosens the crowd up so y'all won't be nervous. But there were two guys sitting at a bar one day. And you know, when you're sitting around a bar room, you'll notice somebody staring. You can feel them staring at you. And guy turned around and he said, I'm sorry for staring. He said, you look very familiar. And the fellow said, I'm sitting here thinking the same thing. He said, where are you from? Guy said, well, I'm from Chicago. Said, I'm from an area in Maryfield, Chicago, Illinois. Born and raised there, I went to Thomas Jefferson High School, played football, graduated in 1963. The guy said, I'm a son of a gun. I did too. He said, I just can't believe that. About that time, the phone rang. Bartender picked up the phone, and he looked around. He said, no, ma'am, he's not here. Said, the only people here are the Miller twins, and they're drunker than hell. So that's what I used to be like. That's what I used to be like. I never knew where I was, who I was, or what I was going to do, and that's the kind of drunk I was. You know, I was a weird kid. I don't want to spend too much time growing up, but I know today that the emotional garbage that collected inside of me had an awful lot to do with the way that alcohol reacted on me, and the way that it made me feel the very first time I ever took a drink. I was born in Greenville, South Carolina, and I never knew my real father. My mother remarried when I was about 4 or 5 years old. So my stepfather was the male figure in my life, and he was a good man. He was a decent human being, a hard worker. He was a political figure in our hometown and owned his own business, but he did have a drinking problem. I don't believe my father was an alcoholic. I think he abused alcohol, certainly, and he had that personality change when he drank, but when he didn't drink, he was a good and decent man, which is not characteristic of the type of alcoholic that I am. So I was brought up in this home, and the thing of importance, I guess, is that I suffer from a disease of perception as well as I do alcoholism, and my perception of my childhood has obviously changed the longer I stay sober. Now, there are some things that are absolute in my childhood, and one of them was that I was born with a hole in my heart. I had a heart condition, and when I was about 3 years old, they detected this problem, and I was a blue baby. When I met Blue, I told Tina, I said, well, Blue's really going to enjoy my story because I was literally blue. I mean, my blood didn't get enough oxygen. I had this hole in my heart, and my fingernails were blue, and my lips were blue, and my cheeks were blue, and I was very different. You know, I was brought up in an all-white neighborhood, went to all-white schools, and I was blue. A lot of people think integration in the South started in the 60s, but I started it in 1951 at Anderson Street Elementary School. I was the first student of color that enrolled there. And obviously, being different and looking different from my peers, some things happened inside of me internally that made me recognize the fact that I just didn't fit in with these folks. And I was a nervous, hyperactive little kid. You know, they're giving Ritalin out now. I read an article about this Ritalin the other day, and I'm sure they probably could have given me that. I certainly was a person that could be diagnosed with that ADHD or what the hell ever it was. They just called me unruly, you know. They just called me unruly. And I was always moving and doing things, and I was a pretty good athlete as a child to the age of 13. I was able to play basketball and football, organized sports in my hometown, and I could run real fast, and I couldn't run far, though. I'd get tired easily, and I'd just have to sit down and rest. So I played sports, and during those years, 10 to 13, I felt like maybe I fit in. That was sort of something to help me bridge the gap between me and my peers, and being a good little athlete, I guess I felt maybe like I was accepted. I don't think I ever really felt that way, but this was as close as it would come. And then when I was 13, during a football game, the man who was in charge of athletics in my hometown came down and said that I was going to have to quit playing. They were afraid that something might happen to me and it might set them up for a suit. And so I had to quit playing sports. And this was very traumatic to me because now all I had was my blue lips and my little bitty short body. And I was just getting ready to go into junior high around a whole new group of kids. And I just felt really out of place. Obviously, I've heard a lot of speakers stand up here and say the same thing. And I really did. I felt like I just didn't fit in. I was very miserable in all this emotional turmoil. Some things were happening at home. You know, my daddy, when he would drink, sometimes my mom and I would have to leave. And there was a lot of things involved in my life that just made me feel like that I just didn't fit in this world. And I knew I didn't. I went off to high school, and we had two high schools in my hometown back then, Greenville and Parker. And there was a big rivalry there, you know, like you have in inner city schools. And I wanted so much to be part of that athletic scene, but I couldn't play sports, and I was too small, and I had this heart condition. But I did ask the coach if I could be a trainer on the football team, and he said that he needed one that year. So I became involved with the athletes and the popular kids there. And, you know, I don't think I really felt like I fit in even then. We had fraternities in high school, and I was asked to join one, and I dated a little girl all through high school. I'm sure that was some sort of status symbol for her, being the only blue person in the whole school, you know. So, you know, as I look back on my high school years, I really had a lot of fun, but by the same token, I had all this emotional stuff going on in me, and I didn't know what to do with it. And of course, like all of us happens, one day I was 17 years old, my senior year in high school, and we played Parker on Thanksgiving Day. And usually after the football game, there was a big fight. And, you know, we didn't fight with guns and knives back then. It was a fist fight. And then you cleaned up and went in and had a Coke. But this particular day in 1962, Thanksgiving Day, after the game, my heroes, the guys that I idolized, the football players and the jocks, they said, said, Blue, we're going to get drunk. You want to go? And I said, sure. Now, I didn't put a lot of thought into this. I'd been around drinking, and I'd gone to the bars with these guys, and I'd just hang out and drink 7-Ups and eat Penrose sausages. and just kind of be bad. That's a real tough job when you're 5'2" and blue. It's people just, they don't really think you're that bad. But anyway, you know, it just never did have any appeal to me. We'd go in these saloons and it stunk. And so this particular day we were going to the soda shop where we all hung out. And I wanted to be part of this. This is peer pressure, I guess, is what you'd call it. And so I went and I bought me a pint of Rebel Yell whiskey. Now, back in those days, if you could see over the counter, they'd sell it to you. So I got me a pint of this Rebel Yell whiskey and went to the soda shop after the football game, and I poured me up some in a Coca-Cola, and I drank it down. And I don't know what happened during the time that I was doing that drinking, but I had all the classic symptoms, as I've come to know, of alcoholism that night. I had a blackout. I got in trouble. I got sick. I passed out, and I came to the next day in my mama's house, and I thought I was going to die. But I had what we call euphoric recall, because what I remembered was, for the first time in my life, I felt like I was part of something greater than me. I felt like I was just like you were. I didn't feel like I was blue anymore. I didn't feel like I was short. I felt like I was part of the crowd. I was right up front and running that mouth and talking to the women and dancing and partying and just having a ball. And I knew that I was going to do that again if I ever got a chance, if I lived. And, you know, I didn't know if I'd live or not, but obviously I did. I went back to school Monday after Thanksgiving, and there was another bonus with this drinking that first time. And apparently there had been a big fight, and I got in a blindside lick on somebody. And the talk of the whole school was what old Blue Boy did. Did you see what Blue did? Did you see what happened to that? And, man, that's what I wanted. I wanted some notoriety. You know, I don't know why I thought I had to go to such extremes to get that, because I was the only blue person in the United States at that time anyway. But I wanted to be famous for something other than that, and finally I was. I graduated from high school. I did well in high school. I did fine, did good enough on the college entrance exams to go just about anywhere in the Southeast, and I had planned to go to the University of South Carolina. But my best friend got a scholarship to Newberry College. And Newberry's a small school about 35 miles west of Columbia. And he said, why don't you go to school? We'll room together, party, and have a good time. And it sounded good. So I did. And I also got to be a trainer on the football team down there. My first semester was pretty good. But being away from home, I had an opportunity to drink just about every day. But now, at Newberry College back in the 60s, you couldn't drink on campus, and there were a lot of strict rules. It's a Lutheran school, and there were a lot of strict rules you had to abide by. You had to be in class, and you had to go to chapel 3 days a week, and classes were from Monday through Saturday. So you had to keep a clear head, and you had to keep yourself kind of straight to do this. And the first semester, I was able to pull that off. But the second semester, all the partying and the carousing and things got the best of me, and I didn't feel like getting up in the mornings, and so I flunked out of school. Now, I went back home, and my health at this time was so bad that if I walked from here to the door there, I'd have to sit down and rest. I just couldn't get enough oxygen. And I was staying with my parents and working for my dad a little bit. I'd drive a truck and carry the guys around. He owned a tire business, and I'd drive the guys around to change tires. And I never felt good unless I was under the influence of alcohol. The only time I felt physically well or mentally or emotionally was when I was drinking. And then, of course, the hangovers were horrendous. I mean, the next day was terrible. My heart condition was such now that we knew something had to be done. So my mom and I went to Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, Maryland, and they did a heart cath, and they determined that the problem I had was operable, and they set up a time for this open-heart surgery in January of 1966. And she and I went back up there, and they operated. The surgeons got with me, and they told me that they said, as soon as we go in and close this hole up, your blood will turn red, and you'll be just like a normal person. And so when they did the surgery, and I came to in the recovery, and they were right, and I was in a lot of pain, but I knew that this surgery had been successful, and indeed it was. In fact, after 6 months after that surgery, I had grown to my present height and weight, and I began shaving, and you know, it's like going through puberty at age 21. I was a late bloomer, and I expect that's why I look so young for my age now, so there's nothing too bad about that. Well, I went back to Greenville, South Carolina, intending to go back to college and get my degree and do what my folks had planned for me. But you know what happened. I'm an alcoholic, and that surgery didn't do anything for that. And I continued to drink. Now I could drink more. My tolerance was extremely high. I could stay out later. We had discovered pep pills by this time. And life was just a great big party for me. And I flunked out of school again, and I came back home. And I went down to the employment office at my dad's request. He said, you know, you're not real good at this college thing. You need to find out what you can do. And they gave me a battery of tests, dexterity tests and MMPIs and all this stuff to find out what I could do. And the results came back a couple of weeks later. This counselor called me and he said, it seems that you would be either a good forest ranger or a lab technician. Now, I don't know what those had in common, but my idea of a forest ranger was somebody in a tower way out there by themselves looking for Smokey the Bear, and that didn't seem too romantic to me. So I opted for this lab tech job, and I got a job in a small chemical company and a growing chemical company, and I worked my way into this position and was doing real well. Obviously, I had youth and health on my side at that point in time, so you could drink and stay out late and still make it to work. But I looked around at my local haunt one day, and all my buddies were gone, and it became obvious that everybody was getting married, and there I was, and I wasn't even dating anybody regularly, so I figured I'd go ahead and get married and have two or three kids and settle down. I met this young lady. She was a Catholic girl, and she was from a family with five brothers and sisters, and I loved everything about the whole scene. I loved her parents. I loved her family. I loved her. She was a beautiful little blonde girl, and I knew that this was the woman I'd spend the rest of my life with. And so we got married, and the first year we were married, things went pretty good, it seemed to me. This is my perception again. I was drinking still, and that's how she met me. We were at some bar somewhere. And going out, and probably the worst thing I did during that first year was I might stay out all night gambling or something like that. But I was going to work. I wasn't violent. I wasn't getting in trouble with the law. And things seemed to be all right with what was going on, at least to me. But now as we moved into our second year, my drinking became a problem to her. And being a Catholic, you know, they were free to drink. They believed in drinking. And her dad and mother drank, and you know, excuse me, we had a good time together. So she thought that maybe we needed to go to see some psychiatrists. Now, I'm not knocking psychiatrists. They probably could have helped me if I'd have needed them. But what I had was not a psychiatric disorder. What I have is alcoholism. And we didn't talk about alcoholism. We talked about the horror stories of being blue growing up in a neighborhood like I did. And we talked about my drinking daddy, whom I made out to be a lot worse than he was. And we talked about all these things. And obviously nothing could be done. We were wasting money. I don't know what they talked about, but I know what he and I talked about. And so we'd go back home and nothing would change. And my drinking's becoming more and more problematic. Things are starting to happen now. And so we decided that there's a few things that we hadn't tried yet. And one of them was that we were living in a real small apartment. And we felt like if we just buy us a nice home out in the suburbs, that things might be different. And now, if Alcoholics Anonymous isn't working for you, might want to try some of this. It didn't work for me, but who knows? It may for you. So we bought this home, and it was the guy that owned it was a retired professor from Bob Jones University, and he had this nice garden out back that was probably half as big as this chapel. And he grew all sorts of things, and we went to look at it with the sales lady, the realtor, and I thought, man, this is going to be good. I can grow our food, and, you know, in two or three months, I can quit work and just have a good time. Well, we bought the house and moved in, and turns out that I didn't have a very green thumb because the first frost that hit and wilted everything, I just took my lawnmower and cut it all, slammed flat to the ground. So then I just had a big yard with a lot of dirt in it, you know, and that didn't work for us. So we decided to have a child. And apparently I stayed home one night and we did everything that was necessary for this and found out that she was pregnant after a couple of months or whatever. And so I told her I'd stop drinking. And for the next 7 months, I didn't touch a drop. I did everything. It looked like I was normal. I can tell you right now, and if you've ever had any dry times, you already know, I was nervous as hell. Everything was just quick. I had to do everything quick. And, you know, I couldn't stand things that were going wrong. It looked like I was fine. I mean, I'd go to work, I'd wash the car, I'd mow the lawn and cut the garden, and I did everything that a husband should do. But I was a nervous wreck. So finally, my son was born on September the 14th, and back then, they'd let you stay in the hospital 2 or 3 days with your child. Now, I think you have to have them in the taxi with the insurance the way it is. But anyway, I was to pick them up on a Saturday, I believe, and I went out Friday night after 7 months of not having anything to drink, and I got tortured, and I had a terrible automobile wreck. But for the grace of God, nobody was seriously hurt. I had some lacerations and stuff on my face and messed up my mouth a little bit and that sort of thing. But I total lost our car. And the next day I went to pick her up at the hospital, and she worked for the OBGYN that delivered our son. And he already had the news. They'd taken me to jail and gave me the breathalyzer. And I got in an awful lot of trouble. But my father got me out of that. And I'm here to tell you, if I hadn't been able to bail my way out or lie my way out or somehow connive my way out of a lot of things I got into, you'd probably have a different speaker today. But I'm not proud of those things, but they did happen. And so my wife and I, for the next few months, our marriage just kind of disintegrated. And in May of 1971, I was going to work one day, and it was a beautiful day. It was warm, and I was nervous, and, you know, I'd been trying to hide my drinking now, and I'd been acting like I wasn't drinking, and God, that's complicated, too. But I went to work, and I was on my way to work, and I thought, you know, I'm just going to take a day off. So I called my boss, and I told him something. I told him one of my lies, I'm sure. And I went on to Newberry. I just went on down the road about 60 miles away, and I was going to shoot pool and drink some beer and have a good time. That's what I was, just relax, you know. This baby had been bawling, and the wife was nagging, and so I did all that. And I was on my way home, and my plan was to come home and, you know, just act like nothing had happened. My wife would think I went to work, my boss would think I was sick, and about 100 yards before the highway splits, one goes to Charlotte and one goes to Greenville, right outside of Spartanburg. There were three hippies out there hitchhiking. And I stopped to pick these young men up. And I asked them where they were going, and they said, well, we're going to Washington, D.C. for a peace march. And I looked at my watch, and I thought, well, you know, I can carry you to Charlotte. And I thought I could. 1 hour up that way, and then another hour and a half, and I'm home. And I just tell my wife I worked late. But by now, alcohol is doing some other things to me. And I know none of y'all ever experienced this phenomenon, but I got real intelligent the more I drank. And by the time we got to Charlotte, there was no reason not to take these fine young men all the way to Washington, D.C. So I did. And I came to the next day in the Georgetown section of Washington. There were 30,000 long hairs out there carrying signs, and I was in what was left of a business suit. And I got on the phone, and I called my wife, and I said, you're not going to believe what happened to me. And she evidently didn't, because when I got home, my father-in-law had come and gotten her and my son, and they packed them up. The next day, I reported to work, only to find out that I'd been fired. And so I was 26 years old. I'd lost my wife, my family, and my job, a job that I'd worked very hard at for about 3.5 years. And I didn't know what to do, but obviously I did what any alcoholic would, and I stayed in my house, and I drank the next 2 weeks as hard as anybody I've ever seen. Drinking to live and living to drink, as the big book talks about, and drinking to die, probably. My mother finally came over, and I let her in, and I had a cousin that had some money, and she was willing to send me to one of these places. And this place was in Battle Creek, Michigan. Now, it's not a treatment center as I know treatment centers. It was called Kellogg Sanitarium. It was run by the Seventh-day Adventists, and these people believed in eating right and exercising and not smoking and drinking. And I went up there, and I was the youngest one there. They had a motel ward for people like me, and they had a lock hospital ward for the old men. I mean, there were some old men up there, too. They'd have group therapy, and they'd take us healthy young bucks up there, and we'd sit at the table, and these old men would come down, and they'd be shaking and yelling. And hell, some of them were 40 years old, and I thought, you know, You know, when I get that old, I'll quit drinking too, but right now I got too much fun left in me. I stayed up there 2 weeks. I dried out, ate the right food, got in pretty good shape, and I went back to Greenville, South Carolina. And by now, my wife and I were separated, and she was living in some apartments on Wade Hampton, and I was living in some about a mile and a half above her. And I called her up, and I said, you know, I'm cured now. I know what to do. I know what's wrong, and I want to get back together, and she wouldn't have anything to do with that. So I resumed my drinking, and, you know, I went back to the Amvets one night, and this was a place where social drinkers drank at 2 and 3 in the morning. And so I was up there, and alcohol is reacting now. I don't even know what's going to happen. You know, there was a time, let me tell you, alcohol never surprised me. It always did what I thought it would do. It got me drunk. It relieved me of the madness that was going on in my mind. It did a lot more than that later on, but this particular night I'm sitting at the bar and I'm, you know, I've got this melancholy thinking, and I'm thinking, she's not coming back. What I'd like to do is go down and find her with another man and kill both of them. You know, that would show them. So I drove down to her apartment. I knew where she lived, and she lived on the ground floor, and I got out. It was 2 or 3 in the morning, as I said, and I creeped up to the window like an alcoholic ninja, and there was a little bush. There was about a foot and a half little hedgerow around her window, and what I didn't know was that underneath that in the basement they had washers and dryers for the tenants. And when you have dryers, you've got to have air vents for this air to come out of. And so I just jumped over that little bush. And I remember the feeling of falling for, it seemed like for days, you know, and then all of a sudden I stopped and I was hanging upside down. My foot had caught in this bush. I jumped in a big old culvert where those air ducts came out. And I was hanging upside down, couldn't touch the sides or the bottom or anything, and the thought came to me that I was probably going to have an aneurysm, and they'd find me in a week or two hanging upside down outside my ex-wife's window. Wasn't going to look good on my family. Anyway, I finally got out, and I knocked on her window, and I said, Nikki, I think I've broken my leg. And she said something like, well, go home and call EMS or something like that, you know. So, you know, for the next couple of years, things got progressively worse, as they always do. I was on unemployment. My father passed away in 1972 and left some insurance, not an awful lot, but he left some insurance money. And in 1974, I had the great idea of going back to Newberry College. And I checked around to find out what I needed to do, and got me some government grants, and with the money my dad left and the blessing of my mother, I went back to Newberry College as a 29-year-old freshman. And I jumped right into that college life. Now, I had me an apartment off campus, a new car, you know, new threads, and a lot of my professors thought I was a Vietnam veteran. And I never told them any different, you know, that if it made them feel okay, it was fine with me. College was much easier. I don't know if I don't think I was any smarter, but college was just a lot easier in those days. And, you know, I joined a fraternity, and I was hanging around with 18, 19, 20-year-olds, and emotionally we were pretty equal, I expect. And so we just had a good time. You know, we had Hell Week there when I joined a fraternity, and part of that was you had to streak through the girls' dormitory naked. And, you know, I was too old and drunk to streak, so I just kind of stumbled through there. But I did everything that they asked me to do. And, you know, if you're going to be part of an organization, you ought to do that. So the 3.5 years I spent at Newberry College, I did get my diploma, and I'm a living example that you can spend 14 years off and on going to college and be untouched by education. So that's the way that happened. But during the course of those 3.5 years, I was in and out of jail down there at Newberry, and I was starting to get in trouble. I'm getting DWIs now, and my life is really, really starting to turn for the worse. I did get through college, and during the summers I'd go to Myrtle Beach and I'd work in a bar down there. Working my way through college, I called it, but what I was doing was I was just having a blast. And so in 77, I was getting ready to graduate, and I'd done enough on my courses. I didn't have to take any exams, and so before graduation, I went down to Myrtle Beach to find a place to live. My plan was to work one more summer down there, and then with my degree, I was going to go coach or teach somewhere like Ohio State, you know. I was just I knew with my general knowledge and my degree I could make a name for myself. And while I was down at Myrtle Beach for 3 or 4 days looking for an apartment or a house or something, I got on a tequila drunk, and tequila was a drug in its own right. It was the kind of thing that I'd start drinking at this podium and I'd come to in front of a judge, and I wouldn't have the faintest idea what happened between here and now, and it was like being in a time warp. And that happened to me then. And I ended up in Lexington Memorial Hospital. I weighed 225 pounds. I was all bloated. I had my cholesterol was off the scale. My liver was, my liver weighed about 180, and the rest was fluid, you know. I was in terrible shape. I was 32 years old, and everything was just bad. My blood pressure, I had congestive heart failure, and all due to drinking. And so this cardiologist, this internist, was my doctor there, and they kept me in the hospital 5 days on IVs and what have you. And he told me the truth about it. He said, you know, you're going to have to quit drinking. You're going to have to go on a diet and do all this stuff. And I did. And I did for the next several months. In fact, if you want to know a miserable existence, you try tending bar and not drinking. I mean a bar where you're running back and forth, not one of these where you lean on the bar and talk to two or three people. If a fight didn't start by midnight, I started one. Now, I was restless, irritable, and discontent. That was a picture of me. And, I'm working 12 or 14 hours a day, and I'm not drinking, and I'm riding a bicycle, I'm working out, and I'm getting myself in good shape physically, but emotionally I am just an absolute wreck. I understand that today. You see, the thing about it is I know that my sponsor used to tell me, he said, drinking didn't make you what you were made you drink. And I understand that today. I understand that before I was 17 years old, if alcohol hadn't intervened in my life, I'd have blown my brains out because I was a miserable person. I had no idea how to live in this world. It made no sense to me. Now, I always believed in God. I need to tell you that up front. I was brought up in the church. I'm active in my church today, and my Alcoholics Anonymous and the religion of my choice parallel one another. There's no conflict of interest there, and I need to make that clear to you. But while I was down at Myrtle Beach during that period of time, I didn't drink, and all these things were going on. And I met a lady that was to become my second wife. Here's a marriage that was made in hell, if ever there was one. We got married because she had a condominium and her mother had one next to her, and her mother would come down from Columbia like every weekend, and I got tired of moving my stuff in and out. So we got married, and I don't remember, it seems like we got married in July, I'm not sure. But anyway, in April of 1979, she and the solicitor and the sheriff of Horry County and several other dignitaries asked me to leave Myrtle Beach. And I did. You know, hell, I'm not going to hang around someplace where they don't appreciate you, you know. And I left, and I came to in Charlotte, North Carolina, and really thought I was going to die. I had resumed drinking, obviously, and the progression of alcoholism picked up. I believe it with all my heart. I can assure you, I appreciate the speakers that have come before me here, Al and Gay and Jimmy. And Al, I am not a misplaced Al-Anon. I know that for sure. I am where I need to be. This is the only place I know where I could learn how to live without alcohol. See, I've come to believe that what is wrong with me, there are two things maybe that can do something for me. And that is alcohol, and alcohol obviously doesn't work anymore, are the spiritual principles that are set forth in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Those two things can help me survive. And the principles can help me survive in a much happier mode than I've ever known before. I came to in Charlotte. I was very sick. I picked up the phone and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And the 7th Street Detox Center was a social setting detox. It was my first trip to one. I'd never been to one before. And I went in there. They told me how to get there. And they didn't give you drugs. You just had to shake it out. And if anything bad came up, they'd get EMS over there. Excuse me. So anyway, I went into this detox center. And back in those days, if you could quit vibrating long enough, AA members would take you out to an AA meeting. They would you know, kind of adopt you for the evening or whatever. And a man came in, and I mentioned this guy Thursday night in the sharing meeting, and what an awesome experience that was, too. But this guy came in, and he's dead now. His name's Bill Hatcher. And Bill was smiling, and he was dressed up, and he was talking to several of the patients in there, and I'm kind of listening, you know. I found out while I was in this detox center that my second wife had filed for divorce, and of course, that depressed me greatly, as much as I loved her, and this was a terrible thing. You know, a two-time loser now, and so anyway, I overheard this man talking. I heard him say he hadn't had a drink in 4 years, and I said, shoot, I don't, you know, find out what else he got to substitute. But anyway, he saw me over there, and he came over, and he didn't ask me anything about me. He didn't ask me where I was from or if I had a job. He just asked me, he said, would you like to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight? And I said, yeah, I'd like to do that. So he took me to my first meeting, April 20th, 1979. A lady got up. She was a concert pianist. She told her story. They gave out the chips. I picked up one, and I went back to detox for another couple of days. And when I got out, I went to Greenville, South Carolina. Bill Hatcher had given me the name of the man who now sponsors me. His name's Sterling Watts. Some of you may know him. And I called him up, and I said, Mr. Watts, I understand you can help alcoholics. And he said, yeah, where you at? I'll call you back. And that's just what he said. And I told him, and he called me back. And he said, there's a meeting Monday night at the New Hope Group. He said, there'll be a man named Ray there to meet you. So I went. For 4.5 months, I went to your meetings. I fellowshipped with you. I'd get there at 8 o'clock. I'd leave at 9 o'clock. I think I might have even bought me a book. Didn't want to hear anything about any steps or principles. The only thing I wanted to do was learn how to stop drinking. That's the only thing I had in mind. After 4.5 months, didn't want to leave this out. During that 4.5 months, I was smoking some of that little left-handed cigarette stuff because that's all the drug story you're going to hear. But I felt like the doctor had even told me that smoking pot wouldn't hurt my condition. And so I went to AA and high most of the time on something. And obviously, it didn't work for me. It didn't work for me. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't get involved. I was on the fringes of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I went back out and tried to do it my way. In the next 3.5 years, I don't have time to tell you about it. I can tell you that it was a living hell, an absolute living hell. I would have never thought that somebody that had the opportunities that I did could do the things that I did, to go the places I went, and to end up being the way that I was. It was absolutely horrifying. And I just, as I stand before you today, it's a miracle that I don't live that way anymore. It's hard to imagine that I ever did, but I did. I got married and divorced again. Now, I went from South Carolina to North Carolina to Florida to Houston, Texas, just running like hell trying to solve this problem. And everywhere I went, the problem was there. And obviously, I was the problem. I could not get away from me, and it was a miserable, absolute miserable existence. I would come back to AA, you know, back and back and back and out, and I never was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I say I had one slip, and that lasted 3.5 years. I didn't really have a slip because if you don't have the program, if you don't understand the principles, then you're not really in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I was fellowshipping, and I see that happening a lot today, but I'm not going to get into that. My sponsor says, carry the news and not your views, and I shall. So anyway, things got worse and worse, and this third wife and I were living with my mother, and the hardest work I had to do was during that period of time, trying not to hurt that blessed mother of mine and trying not to hurt this wife that I had known 2 weeks before we got married. And God, it was just awful. In and out of hospitals, in and out of jails, and in and out of detox centers. After a year of marriage, this third wife had to leave. And about a year later, I came to what I pray to God was the bottom of my life. I want to read a part of Alcoholics Anonymous in a vision for you that describes those last days. I'm sure many of you have experienced this too. And it says, for most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy with friends, and a feeling that life is good. But not so with us in those last days of heavy drinking. The old pleasures were gone. They were but memories. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past. It was an insistent yearning to enjoy life as we once did, and a heartbreaking obsession that some new miracle of control would enable us to do it. There was always one more attempt and one more failure. And thus I found myself in December of 1982. It talks about the four horsemen on down. It talks about the four horsemen of terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And I knew them very well. I came to a detox center, strapped down in four-point restraints. I found out that they had rushed me to the emergency room twice with congestive heart failure. I was in my hometown of Greenville, South Carolina, and I had been in this detox center many times before. And when I came to and I had that moment of clarity, the first thing I did was I called this old man that was the man who was to save my life. And I asked him, I said, "Jim, I want to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous." And he said, "You can come back to Alcoholics Anonymous, but as far as I'm concerned, the hell with you." And boy, that broke my heart, because this old man had been sober 38 years, and if anybody knew, he knew. And of course, he didn't mean that. And so I got out on December 3rd, 1982, and I went to the Alano Club, and Jim was out there, and I. He said, "Young man, are you ready to do what we ask you to do?" I said, "Yeah, I'll do anything." And so, for the next 11 months, he took me by the hand, and he carried me through the steps of recovery. And when I was 9 months sober, I went to his house one Sunday morning after the 11th step meeting, and I did my fifth step with this man. And I stayed with him for 3.5 to 4 hours, and I told him everything that I had on that yellow legal pad. And he said, "I've heard a lot of fifth steps," but he said, "I've never heard one any more thorough." Now, I don't know if he was lying or not, but it did an awful lot to me and for me, because I left there that day and I had that freedom that we know about in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I worked the sixth and seventh steps, and I had my amends list, and to the best of my knowledge, I've made every amend that I know of today. And that brought me to 10, 11, and 12. And those are the steps of maintenance and steps of growth as I know them today, as I understand them today. It's still sometimes hard for me to say that I'm wrong and you're right, but I have to do that. I have to do that. And when I do, I feel much better. I meet God every morning. And Tina and I, we have our morning meditation and we have our prayer. And I read some AA literature. Daily Reflections is one of my favorites, because that's a book by alcoholics, for alcoholics. And I love the promises that were read today, because the promises used to be read at a lot of meetings when I first got sober. And those were the things that kept me hanging around, because, God, I wanted that to happen in my life. See, alcohol did that for me at first. Alcohol made all those promises come true to me. And, I was real interested in that part about financial insecurity. I was real interested in that. I'm happy to say that that's come true in my life today. I'm broke on a higher level than I've ever been before. So if you're new here and you're worried about financial insecurity, just keep coming back, because that'll take care of itself. A lot of wonderful things have happened in my life. When I was 5 years sober, when I was 3 years sober, I went to work in the field of alcoholism, and I worked for a community-based agency, and then I got a job in a treatment center, and then I started feeling some pains of the job, and I was getting AA confused with my work, and my sponsors had to come talk to me and say, "Look, what you do for a living and what you do to live are two different things," and they said, "You need to go to your AA meetings," and I understood that. I got an offer to go to North Carolina to get back in textiles. And I was looking for something new. I had taken a cut in pay to get in the field of alcoholism, and so I got a job offer that was just too financially appealing for me to turn down, and so I moved to Valdez, North Carolina. I was up there, and I was working for this guy, and I had some more heart problems, and in February of 1988, they rushed me to Charlotte Memorial Hospital, and they had to cut me open and they put a pig valve in where the pulmonary valve was, so they had I had a valve replacement. And the position I had with this textile firm, it was one that had to be, somebody had to be there to do it, so he had to hire somebody. And after 8 months of, 8 weeks of recuperating, he put me back on the payroll for nothing. I mean, this guy, obviously he's a good guy. He was the best man in my wedding when Tina and I got married. But, you know, he was paying me a salary, and all I was doing was showing up and telling jokes, basically. So I had an offer to go to work in the prison system for Tom Ivester at a youth prison as a director of the DART program. And in 87, I did that. In 89, I did that. January of 89. And I stayed there about a year, and then an opening came open for a private nonprofit council on alcoholism, and I put my name in the hat, and they hired me as a director there, and I've been there ever since, and I've never looked back. It's a tremendous opportunity. I know today that Alcoholics Anonymous is where I go for my life. I do not get my job confused with my life. I was sitting at my desk one day, I don't know, 6.5 years ago, and this young lady walked in to sell me an insurance policy, a group policy. And I'm still paying on it, ladies and gentlemen. my sponsors, they thought that, you know, when I was 11 months sober, Jim passed away, and it was a tremendous loss to not only me but the AA community. But there were two men waiting in the wings to take me under their wing and to sponsor me. And I got Alcoholics Anonymous from this book. You know, this is what I know about AA. I don't know any other thing. I see a lot of other things, but I don't know what they mean. And so I try to stick with this, and I give away what was given to me. That's all I got. I can't make up anything. There's nothing original for me. But anyway, my sponsors all seemed to think that I had a problem with the fairer sex, and they told me that you will not date for a year. I said, damn, a year? I was sober 8 years before I ever dated. I'm sure Jim's sitting up there smiling right now thinking, well, I'm sure I went out with some girls, you know, but anyway, Tina walked in, and a few months later I asked her to go out to eat, and we drove to Greenville, South Carolina and had dinner, and we've been together ever since, and I love her like a rainbow. She's my best friend. I don't always treat her like that, but she is. And, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me an opportunity to live, and that's all I wanted. When I came back, I thought if they can just show me how not to drink, I'll be happy. But it's been so much more than that. You know, it's been a way to connect with God that I knew as a child. And my belief and dependence upon Him is as real to me as anything I know. I sponsor two or three guys today, and I think some people do this sponsor thing better than I do. You know, I don't know that I'm very good at that. All I do is tell them the truth, and it seems that not everybody wants to hear the truth. I didn't want to hear the truth for a while, but the truth set me free, and that's what I've got to tell these other young men that come to me and ask me to sponsor them. I watched my son go to prison when he was 17 years old, and he got out. He did 2 years, and he got out. He came to live with me, and he didn't do what I needed him to do, and so I had to pack him up and make him leave my home, and he was a young man. He was 20 years old, and it was the hardest thing I ever had to do. But I know that my sobriety comes before anything else, and he was threatening that with his behavior. My son's 27 years old now, and he lives in Virginia. Tina and I went up to visit him and his girlfriend, and he was working at that time. He was not in jail, so it was a good day. I love my son. I never stopped loving him because he did things, you know. He wasn't an alcoholic or a drug addict. He was a thief. And apparently not a very good one, because he did get caught. But we have a good relationship today. In March of 1996, my mother passed away. She was 87 years old. The last 5 months of her life, she was in intensive care with tubes and what have you coming out of her, and she suffered a great deal. And God, in His infinite mercy, took her home. 3 days after my birthday, after my belly button birthday. And but my mother got to see me stay sober for 13 years and become a productive member of society. That's a gift. That's a gift. I miss her. I miss Jim. I miss some of the old timers that have come my way. But that's life, you know. That's life. We're only here for a little while. I was on a program, as I said, with Bob and Juanita and Cersei W. from Dallas, Texas, 50 years sober. And he said, if you're not having a good time in Alcoholics Anonymous, something's wrong. I'll tell you what, I have as much fun as anybody I know. I never believed that an old man like I am now could have this much fun, but it's been wonderful. It's been wonderful. I want to thank the committee. I want to thank all of you for being so nice to us. We've just had a wonderful time. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't always express it well, but I can tell you, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to leave you with the last paragraph on page 164, and it covers the 12 steps. It says, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you so much.